Thank you, Ray Charles. Thank you so much. None of us are free if one of us is chained, he says. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, November the 28th, and today... Oh, the 29th, I'm sorry. I almost put myself one day... got an extra day. The 29th, and today we get a history lesson. The movie Lincoln focuses on the efforts of the 16th president to get a recalcitrant Congress to pass the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. Our guest today provides the often missing narrative that freedom wasn't given, it was got. Dr. Harry Jones is the assistant director and curator of the African American Civil War Memorial, Freedom Foundation, and Museum in Washington, D.C. He is one of the foremost authorities on the role of African Americans in the Civil War, and as you will hear today, presents a refreshingly new perspective on the subject, revealing how extensive and well-organized African Americans struggled to end slavery. His presentation today, titled The Road to Emancipation, is based on his book titled For Light and Liberty, How the War to Preserve the Union Became a War to End Slavery. He's a native of Paul's Valley, Oklahoma, and served in the U.S. Marine Corps for more than 20 years, retiring as a captain in 1997. Thank you, Dr. Jones, for being with us today.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I am looking forward to this. I must tell you, and I share with the audience, I was on a tour with the United African Movement. They conducted a bus tour back in early spring. And I was privileged to be in the audience attending one of your lectures, and I was just riveted. And I said, I just have to share this with the audience, and here we are today. So here's how we'll do this. You will make your presentation uninterrupted, and then we'll take a break and go straight to questions right after that. So take it away.
Well, I'd like to talk about our biggest hurdle in telling this story. It is over the years, the story has been told that the American Negro did little or nothing to free himself. 10% of the Northern Army was comprised of men of African descent. 25% of the Northern Navy was comprised of men of African descent. According to the U.S. Census 1860, African Americans only made up 1% of the Northern population. Yet 10% of the Northern Army, 25% of the Northern Navy, very clear overrepresentation. And of course, with this clear overrepresentation, we would think that the story of these soldiers and sailors would be an integral part of that master narrative of the Civil War presented in our schools. But that is not true, and it's not true in the 21st century. The story of these African American freedom fighters remains one of the best kept secrets in American history. And African Americans before the Civil War had prepared for it. They believed that a war was coming. Martin Delaney would write in 1859 in a novel that is really a code book. It's called Blake or the Huts of America. It was published in a journal called The Anglo-American, published by Robert Hamilton out of New York City. Delaney would write, "I now impart to you the secret. It is this. I have laid a scheme and matured a plan for a general insurrection of the slaves in every state and the successful overthrow of slavery." Indeed, African Americans had a plan going into the Civil War. But in the African American community, there was a debate on how this plan should be formed and who our allies should be. Much like the debate within the abolitionist movement in the European American community, there were those like in the European American community, James Birney, that argued that the Constitution was a pro anti-slavery document and that in league with the Constitution, you could end slavery, while William Lloyd Garrison argued that the Constitution was a pro-slavery document and that we should rewrite it. We should jettison the Constitution. Indeed, in 1851, a group of African Americans meeting in Columbus, Ohio, would have a resolution before them introduced by Hezekiah Ford Douglas, no relation to Frederick Douglass. Hezekiah Ford Douglas said that the Constitution was, quote, a guilty compromise with slavery in order to form the Union, close quote. And Douglas advocated that African Americans renounce the Constitution. William Howard Day, a native of New York City, a graduate of Oberlin College, 1847, he rose and said that Mr. Douglas was confusing the Constitution with the men who had implemented it, and that was like confusing the Bible with preachers who sin, that he was not going to throw away his Bible because preachers sin. He was not going to throw away the Constitution because of the frailties of these men. And Day would declare, quote, I consider the Constitution the foundation of American liberties, and wrapping myself in the flag of the nation, I will plant myself upon that Constitution, and using the weapons they have given me, I would appeal to the American people for the rights thus guaranteed, close quote. Day would win, let us say Day's resolution would win the day at a vote of 28-2. So the young radicals in 1851 decided that indeed they were going to work in league with the Constitution, believing that under that Constitution, a war was in the future. Much like David Walker had forecasted back in 1829 in his appeal to colored citizens of the world, stating that that if these great houses, which means Pharaoh, did not set the captives free, indeed they were going to be cursed and bring sword against sword, brother against brother, a civil war. And so America's African descent population is preparing for a civil war a decade before it begins, clearly. But the forecast had been much earlier than that, as evidenced in David Walker's appeal to colored citizens of the world. Well, but one of the best examples of the forecast of the civil war comes in 1858, March 5th, 1858, Dr. John S. Rock, born in Salem, New Jersey in 1825, a graduate of the American Medical College in Philadelphia in 1852, Dr. Rock was a physician, a dentist, a school teacher, and the first African-American lawyer to be admitted to the bar of the U.S. Supreme Court. Dr. Rock gave a speech in Boston on March 5, 1858. The occasion was the anniversary of the Boston Massacre. March 5th, 1770, Crispus Atticus, a man of African descent, was the first to lose his life in what became the American Revolution. Dr. Rock's speech on March 5th, 1858 was delivered 3 years, 1 month, and 8 days before the Civil War begins, and Dr. Rock said, and I quote, sooner or later, the clashing of arms will be heard in this country, and the black man's services will be needed. 150,000 freemen capable of bearing arms, and not all cowards and fools, and 750,000 slaves, wild with the enthusiasm caused by the dawn of the glorious opportunity of being able to strike a genuine blow for freedom, will be a power which the white man will be bound to respect. Will the blacks fight? Of course they will. Close quote. Clearly, 3 years before the Civil War begins, Americans of African descent are forecasting a civil war. And they believe that this war will be caused by the contention over what will happen in new territories, whether they will be slave or free. So the Nebraska Act, the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, is something that had already been passed, and Kansas had already become known as Bloody Kansas, and there was a great deal of contention. So today we often hear a debate on whether the war was about slavery or not, but after Lincoln is elected, seven states would secede from the Union before he was inaugurated. The solution to this secession that the 36th Congress, the lame duck Congress, came up with, and the President of the United States at that time, the 15th President, James Buchanan, dealt with what they thought the problem was. And it was a 13th Amendment to the Constitution that passed both the House and the Senate on March 2nd, 1861. And that resolution dealt specifically with slavery. It read that no amendment to the Constitution which will authorize or give Congress power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or servitude by the laws of said state, This amendment to the Constitution deals with slavery. So the solution to secession was to pass an amendment to the Constitution through the House and Senate that was, of course, never ratified, that addressed the issue of slavery and Congress's ability to pass legislation dealing with slavery. And this was addressing Declaration Number 8 of the Republican platform that Lincoln ran on. In Declaration Number 8, they made it very clear that they would address the issue of slavery, that the Republicans would reject the issue of slavery through legislation when necessary. Now, I emphasize this. This becomes very important in understanding the course of events. Through legislation when necessary. And so the counter to that was this 13th Amendment, and Buchanan and the 36th Congress, their hope was, or those who supported this in the 36th Congress, their hope was that this would induce the seven states that had seceded from the Union to return to the Union. Of course, we know they did not. And open hostilities in the Civil War would begin on April 12, 1861, with the firing on Fort Sumter, Charleston Harbor, South Carolina. There were 34 states in the Union when the Civil War began. Slavery was legal in 15 of those 34 states, and by the summer of 1861, 11 of those 15 slaveholding states had seceded from the Union, declared their independence from the United States, and formed their capital and established their capital in Richmond, Virginia. Now, on April 15th, Abraham Lincoln would call for 75,000 volunteer soldiers from the states.
Oh, we lost him. I don't know why. We'll try getting back. Some connection malfunction, so we'll get him back online. Well, until we do, until we hear and that he's back with us, it's shaping up so far that the whole issue of slavery was not a benevolent idea. It was a pragmatic solution. And where the African Americans were concerned, this was not just a passive business waiting for deliverance. They were very animated, very involved, and already strategically planning how to deal with the coming Civil War. They saw it. They saw it coming, and therefore began the process of strategically planning to situate themselves advantageously in this fight that they saw coming among, let's say, the white America was fighting and was going to be involved in a protracted fight. How do they situate themselves to get what they wanted in this fight that was coming? And what they wanted more than anything else was freedom. So this already just dashes the notion that African Americans just sat around waiting for somebody to just give them freedom. No, they were very much involved in strategizing for it. And this is a wonderful, wonderful service already to completely throw that notion out of the window. Our guest is Dr. Hari Jones, H-A-R-I Jones, the Assistant Director and Curator of the African American Civil War Memorial Freedom Foundation and Museum in Washington, D.C. The presentation today is based on his book, The Road to Emancipation, and it will be available. He will tell us how to get a copy of his book. We are waiting to reconnect with him. The phones have just gone dead. All right, let's take this break. We'll come right back, and let's hope we can figure out how to solve this problem. We'll be right back. Thank you. We are having to recoup. There is a technical issue that made the system crash, And so they are working on it. I apologize for that, and certainly I apologize to Dr. Jones for having his presentation interrupted that way. But things happen, and we are not in control of them. But our system just went down, and they're working feverishly to bring them back up. As it is, I'm told that we can receive calls, but the connection out is not working. The phone connection out is not working. So in the meantime, we can take a call or two about issues that are on your mind at 1-888-874-4888. Until we reconnect with Dr. Jones, we still have some time that we can do that. 1-888-874-4888. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Sometimes these things happen, and like I said, you know, you don't see them coming, but they do, and we just have to cope with them. But our system just did go down, and we're just trying to recruit. Okay, he is back. Thank you. Dr. Jones, you're back.
Yes, yes.
I am so sorry. We had a crash, and so okay. They of our system, and it is back up and running. So I'm so sorry to have interrupted your presentation, but do continue from where
okay.
you left off.
Well, we were at where Lincoln has called for 75,000 troops from the states. The war has begun. Congress isn't in session, so Lincoln has to take executive actions that are not authorized by the Constitution. The calling for the troops was not authorized by the Constitution from the executive. Also, Lincoln would call for a special session of Congress. Congress was scheduled to meet in December of 61, but he would call for them to meet in July of 61. Now, with this call for troops, men of African descent could not answer that call for troops because it was illegal at that time for African Americans to join the Federal Army. It had been illegal since 1792 when Congress passed the United States Volunteer Militia Act of 1792, and President George Washington signed that legislation into law. Emphasis here is that it was against the law for African Americans to join the Federal Army. If men of African descent are to be legally armed during the war, it would take an act of Congress. And also, with slavery, though many would argue that Lincoln had the war powers to emancipate slaves, Lincoln did not share that argument because he believed that it would be the legislative branch. It would be led by legislation first, and that that it would be their authority that would give him the authority given to them to Congress to pass laws, and that he would enforce those laws. But Congress's first act when they come in July is to define what the war is about. And they pass a resolution, a joint resolution, written in the Senate by a slaveholder, Andrew Johnson, and in the House by a slaveholder, John Crittenden. Crittenden from Kentucky, Johnson from Tennessee, stating why the federal government was going to war. And it read that they were going to war to, quote, maintain the supremacy of the Constitution and to preserve the Union and not to overthrow or interfere with slavery. Lincoln would affirm this resolution. So the federal objective in the Civil War was clear. The war was being fought to preserve the Union. So all alliances that would be built by Lincoln during the war, the connecting goal is to preserve the Union. The paramount objective is to preserve the Union and not to end the tyranny of slavery. In the first year of the war, the Union is doing well in some regions of the country, but in the most important region of the country, in the eastern part of the country, in particular the Virginia Theater, the Union isn't doing so well. In fact, Lincoln has his top general assigned to the Virginia Theater, George McClellan. Now, Lincoln does not believe that Congress would pass any legislation concerning emancipation until it became an indispensable military necessity. Frederick Douglass in 1861 would argue that he had very good evidence to the fact that the Lincoln administration, notwithstanding appearances, stood ready to enforce a policy in the rebellious states that would eventually abolish slavery in those rebellious states just as soon as the people required it. What does he mean by as soon as the people required? As soon as Congress passes the required legislation. But again, Lincoln did not believe that Congress would pass such legislation until it became an indispensable military necessity. McClellan has assembled arguably the best trained and best equipped army in the world by the spring of 1862. He would march that army up the Virginia Peninsula to within 10 miles of the rebel capital by June 1, 1862. On that same day, General Robert E. Lee would take command of the rebel forces in defense of Richmond. General Lee's army was less than half the size of McClellan's army. But Lee was able to deceive McClellan into believing that his army was four times its actual size. Lee was able to deceive McClellan into believing that wooden cannons were real cannons. Now, how was Lee able to win this intelligence battle in the Peninsula Campaign? Now, remember, McClellan's army is the largest army in the Western Hemisphere. It's within 10 miles of Richmond. And when Lee takes over, he's able to deceive McClellan. Well, McClellan is getting information from Alan Pinkerton, his head of intelligence. And Pinkerton, by the spring of 1862, is almost wholly dependent on African Americans for information. A secret organization that Pinkerton referred to as the Loyal League, and Pinkerton would say about these men, quote, although as yet prevented from taking up arms in defense of their rights, these colored men had banded themselves together to further the cause of freedom, close quote. So this secret African American organization is providing information to Pinkerton and therefore to McClellan. And the information they provide is horrible. It's not any good at all. In fact, it is the key to Lee's success in the Peninsula Campaign. And why do I say it's the key to Lee's success? The information led McClellan to believe that Lee's army was four times its actual size, so McClellan looks like an idiot who won't use his forces properly, when in fact his intelligence is telling him that he's up against a much larger army on the defensive. And so McClellan is forced to withdraw. And when word gets to Washington in the first week of July 1862 that McClellan's army, the largest army in the Western Hemisphere, was in full retreat, suffering a humiliating defeat, Congress would subsequently pass the Militia Act of 1862, granting President Lincoln the authority to bring men of African descent into the federal army. That legislation, born of military necessity, was on President Lincoln's desk for signature on July 17, 1862. Another important piece of legislation was on President Lincoln's desk that day. It is referred to as the Second Confiscation Act. And in the Second Confiscation Act, Congress declared forever free all persons held as slaves by supporters of the rebellion. When President Lincoln signed those two pieces of legislation into law on the 17th of July, 1862, he had the legal authority to bring men of African descent into the federal army and to declare free slaves in states in rebellion. Now, this legislation was the product of military necessity, and we can see the role of the Loyal League, this secret African-American organization, men and women who believed that the war was coming before it came, who had prepared for the war, who had helped make this war, in many ways by their misinformation, to a war for emancipation. And Lincoln believes, at this time, that the only way you're going to win the war is with the aid of African-Americans. However, he also knows that if he just issues a proclamation, or let us say he's advised, actually William Seward would advise him not to issue the proclamation immediately because it would have political effects in the North. And Seward tells him that if you issue it after these, or advise him not to issue it after these humiliating defeats, because if the president did, quote, it would be viewed in the mind of the people as the last measure of an exhausted government, a cry for help, the government stretching out its hands unto Ethiopia instead of Ethiopia stretching out her hands unto the government, close quote. Seward advised Lincoln to wait for a military success that would mask his cry for help to African Americans. Lincoln called this advice wise advice. A prudent president takes wise advice. Lincoln waited to claim his victory. He would claim his victory on the bloodiest day in American history, not the bloodiest battle, but the bloodiest day, September 17, 1862, a battle about 85 miles northwest of Washington near Sharpsburg, Maryland. Officially, it is called the Battle of Antietam. In 12 hours, 22,000 casualties. Well, over half of those casualties were Union soldiers, but the rebel army under Robert E. Lee withdrew from the battlefield, so the Union army under George McClellan claimed a victory. With his victory in hand, Lincoln would issue the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation on September 22, 1862, warning the states in rebellion that if they did not return to the Union by the 1st of January, 1863, he was going to declare free their slaves. Well, the rebels did not believe that Lincoln and the Union Army could make good this threat because they actually believed they were winning the war. They called the Battle of Antietam a draw, a tie, not a defeat. So they're not about to return to the Union because of Lincoln's threat. On January 1, 1863, President Lincoln would issue the final Emancipation Proclamation as, quote, a fit and necessary war measure for suppressing said rebellion, close quote. The president's language in the proclamation makes it very clear that the Emancipation Proclamation was a fit and necessary war measure. Lincoln believed that the only way to win the war was to take that enslaved population of the South and turn it against the South, to create work stoppages. But also, he believed that by arming men of African descent, and this is in the Emancipation Proclamation where he orders his generals to arm men of African descent, by arming men of African descent, he could bring the war to a conclusion sooner. After the Emancipation Proclamation is issued on January 1, 1863, he would immediately start writing his generals, John Dix, the commander of Union forces at Fortress Monroe on the Virginia Peninsula, telling him to start recruiting men of African descent. Out in Louisiana, he would send Daniel Uelman from New York, a gentleman from New York, out there to recruit Uelman's African Brigade, and they would aggressively be recruiting. He would tell the governor of Tennessee, the provisional governor of Tennessee, Andrew Johnson, the military governor of Tennessee, Andrew Johnson, that 50,000 African-American soldiers on the Mississippi River would bring this war to a conclusion. He would write to General Grant, telling General Grant that he wanted him to vigorously support the recruitment of these men of African descent. And Grant would write back to Lincoln and tell Lincoln, even if I didn't support recruiting these colored men, I would do it, because I'm a good general and I obey my orders. But he says, I do support it. And he says, I support it because, quote, by arming the Negro, we have added a powerful ally, close quote. Notice the general's language. Did not say by freeing the Negro. Said by arming the Negro. And he did not say we simply added more bodies to our army. We've added a powerful ally. The importance of African-American soldiers in the Civil War has been one of the best-kept secrets in American history. And even when it comes to Lincoln, there is a way of presenting Lincoln to make it appear that he did not support arming men of African descent and bringing them into the army. The primary source is Lincoln's letters, which are online at the Library of Congress, does not support this commonly held thesis that Lincoln was slow and didn't really want to arm men of African descent. No, Lincoln understood the political realities. He knew what it meant to get political support, and he knew that by arming men of African descent, he could win the war, or let us say he believed it strongly. In fact, he would write a letter to unconditional Union men and tell them that these, you're not fighting for the Negro. You're not fighting to free the Negro. This is an August 1863 letter. He says, they're fighting for you. The Negro is fighting to keep the Union in. And that the Negro is not being fought for. He is fighting for. He is fighting for the Union and literally fighting to emancipate himself. The only way the Emancipation Proclamation would free the enslaved is that it had to be enforced. It only applied to the 10 states that were in rebellion, the 10 states that were in a bloody war against the United States for their independence. So the only way those enslaved would be set free is that that proclamation had to be enforced by saving the Union. And that's what Lincoln is informing these unconditional Union men in August 1863, that these Negroes, these men of African descent, are fighting to preserve the Union. And it is by preserving the Union that they will free themselves. So they're fighting for themselves, and they're fighting for those who seek to preserve the Union. That story is one of the best-kept secrets in American history. And by the end of 1863, Lincoln would tell Congress that the slave had proven his manhood, that he had proven that he could fight in the infantry. He cites battles like the battle at Port Hudson, Milliken's Bend, Fort Wagner. He would say that the Negro, we've always known that he could fight in artillery because of his work on the cannons in the Navy. The Navy was integrated, and African-American gunners on the ships had proven themselves as being very worthy of being on those cannons. And Lincoln also would add to his message to Congress a report from Mississippi where an African-American cavalry unit had defeated a larger number of Confederates. And so he would actually argue, now, see, they can even fight as cavalry. And then he would go on to say, you need to amend your law to give them equal pay. So Lincoln is committed to saving the Union, and he understands that the way to save the Union is by getting America's African descent population on the side of the Union. whether we're talking work stoppages in the South or whether it is fighting as soldiers. And fighting as soldiers becomes very important. And that's one of the things I liked about Spielberg's Lincoln, is that when he brings African Americans into the picture, he brings them in as soldiers, not just the people who were working as a seamstress in the cab, in for Mary Todd Lincoln, the First Lady, Elizabeth Keckley, or Nona Slade, who was working there as a servant in the White House. But he brings soldiers into the picture because Lincoln believed that these men were important in saving the Union. And when Lincoln is pushing for that 13th Amendment to be ratified before that the 37th Congress, the lame duck 37th Congress, ends its session, that is a commitment to emancipation, not a commitment simply to saving the Union. The war can be won without the 13th Amendment now. So that's evidence of something else in Lincoln that doesn't get discussed often. In fact, we've been shaping him as someone who really wasn't in support of emancipation, when in fact what Lincoln believed was that the coalition to end slavery, to save the Union, had to be a Union-centered coalition, and that was correct. That was a correct political decision on the part of Lincoln. Also, what was a good political and military decision by Lincoln is he would bring men of African descent into the Federal Army, and their resume in the Civil War would be impressive. They would capture Charleston, South Carolina on February 18, 1865. African descent soldiers captured Charleston, South Carolina. They would capture Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, on April 3, 1865. Yes, African descent soldiers captured Richmond, Virginia. They would stop Robert E. Lee's army at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, on April 9, 1865, thus forcing Lee to surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. 13 African-American regiments were present at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, on April 9, 1865, when Lee surrendered to Grant. Also, these African-American soldiers would force the governor of Texas. There would be 20,000 African-American soldiers in Texas on June 15, 1865, when they chased the governor of Texas and 10,000 Confederate soldiers across the Rio Grande into Mexico, forcing them out of the United States and bringing Texas back in the Union by military force. Often when we celebrate Juneteenth, we celebrate it as the word of the proclamation getting to Texas on June 19, 1865. The reason that is happening in the African-American community today is because we've been deprived of our history. We've been given a story that's a false story. You are not freed by the proclamation by hearing about it. You're not freed by the pen, but you were freed by the sword. And these African-American soldiers carried that sword, forced Texas back in the Union, conquered Texas, and freed themselves. One of the best kept secrets in American history is the story of how these African-American soldiers helped save the Union, freed themselves by enforcing the Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln's loyalty to their service is his support of that 13th Amendment, and that 13th Amendment was not given to them. It was earned on the battlefield. And that concludes this. I know we're short of that.
Thank you so much. It was a riveting presentation. Your calls at 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. We won't take a break. We're going to go straight through to compensate for our lost time. Dr. Harry Jones, H-A-R-I Jones, is the author of the book upon which the presentation is based. The Road to Emancipation is based on the book For Light and Liberty, How the War to Preserve the Union Became a War to End Slavery. Dr. Jones, how does a person get a copy of this book?
They can get it through the museum right now, the African American Civil War Museum. Our website is afroamcivilwar.org. That's afroamcivilwar.org. You can order it through our museum website.
Why did you take this particular project on?
Well, years ago, I actually was at the University of Oklahoma and had a professor that said African Americans didn't do much in the Civil War, and that's why he didn't teach it. And when I got a couple of books written by African American veterans in the Civil War and presented them to him, he said it wasn't on his syllabus. So I decided that that I would dedicate much of my life to researching and finding primary sources that I might be one day able to convince professors to put this information on their syllabus so that we can start teaching this story. I grew up with the story that that we had freed ourselves and saved the Union. My great-great-grandmother, Stella Whitfield, her father, my great-great-grandfather, Edward Whitfield, was a soldier in the Civil War, and she was very proud of his service and would talk proudly of it and how he had fought for and won his own freedom. And so I grew up with that understanding of our history, and I wanted the rest of America to understand that history as well.
I want to ask one question as we await calls at 1-888-874-4888. The military aspect of it is pretty clear. What was the process of negotiating with a recalcitrant Congress? What was the input of African Americans there in terms of legislative support?
Early on, Douglas is the key when we talk about legislative support. Often we want to make Douglas into advisor to Lincoln, but that's kind of not where Douglas fits into the picture. Douglas is a well-read journalist. His journal, the Douglas Monthly, is well-read, and he's admonishing people to send petitions to their congressmen, to go to Congress if they can and meet with their congressmen to get the laws changed. So it's that lobby in Congress, that effort to lobby Congress and support them. And then in some areas of the country, it's African-American voters. And we often ignore the African-American voters because they're small in number. But in tight elections, that minority that's small in number becomes very important. So it's their work in lobbying Congress and understanding how the system works. I think most importantly, it's understanding how the system works that they do it. Douglas would be the person that is lobbying the European-Americans the most. And as far as just establishing an infrastructure that many people are being advised that you can use, it's Martin Delaney and a gentleman by the name of John Jones out of Chicago that early in the war, you see letters to Lincoln where they're telling of Delaney's impeccable integrity and how he's someone that can be trusted. And Delaney would offer to the War Department a network, not just an individual. He said, we can command all the intelligent black men as agents in the United States. So it's you got that lobbying effort from Douglas, and then you got the operational side of things coming from Martin Delaney principally in your research. That's the name you would query. William Howard Day is playing a major role, but he's more elusive.
Bill from White Plains, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, hello. Thank you very much for the show and taking my call. You said it started as a war to preserve the Union. We all know that the North and the South both profited from slavery. What was the original cause that caused the fracture of the Union and the South to secede like that?
Well, you know, whenever I deal with the original cause, Bill, I always look for the solution of those who were in power at the time, and there is a number of activities going on. One is a peace commission that's meeting in the Willard Hotel in the late winter of 1861, led by John Crittenden, who at that time was a senator from Kentucky, and in the Crittenden Compromise, also known as the Franklin Compromise, they come up with a number of resolutions that all address the issue of slavery. Slavery in the territories, the apprehension of fugitive slaves, and the whole idea is to induce these states that had seceded from the Union to return to the Union. And in their ordinances of secession, they made it very clear that they believed that this new Republican administration and the Republican Party was going to try to abolish slavery where it already existed. But it is in that 13th Amendment that Buchanan has the Congress draft. It was drafted by a special committee of 33, led by Thomas Corcoran, a Republican out of Ohio. And in that 13th Amendment, they deal with slavery and prohibiting Congress from passing any legislation that would abolish slavery. So when I look to the solutions, they address the issue of slavery, which means that clearly means that the people who were in the know in that day considered the problem to be the question of slavery and whether the South could indeed maintain that system of slavery with this new Republican Party. And the new Republican Party, in their platform, Declaration Number 8 of their platform, had made it very clear that they were going to address the issue of slavery by legislation when necessary.
So there were no other broader economic, political issues above slavery than those.
I think that when we deal with the economic realities of slavery, we have to include all those broader aspects of it, because we can look at the central issue and how they came to, how they were addressing it, trying to solve it. But it's such a big issue, it has residual effects in American life. For example, the issue of slavery was important to Northern laborers. In fact, with the Emancipation Proclamation, many Northerners were made afraid, were told to be afraid by, like, say, in New York, Horatio Seymour. His campaign in 1862 was that they're going to emancipate these slaves, they're going to come here and compete for your jobs, and that's going to drive the wages down. So it's a really very complex. When we talk about slavery, slavery isn't a simple issue of just holding people as property, but it's a complex economic issue in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill, for your call.
Thank you.
Lindsay from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Hi, I would like to thank your guest and you, Utrice, for bringing this subject to the forefront. I will do more research and I will look more into the 13th Amendment. I never knew it was so packed with so much power, and it is very, very intriguing. And I thought one of the interesting things that was mentioned in the conversation between you and the doctor was the fact that it was not by the pen but by the sword. And while we don't support, you know, violence per se, you know, we had to fight, literally fight for this. This did not come to us on a silver platter. There was no policy per se that was put forth that, you know, opened the way. We literally had to physically earn our keep and earn our platform. And again, I thank you very much for bringing this to light, and I will continue to do research and spread the word. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Jones, what this means, I'll translate Lindsay's call, is that you've got to get back here again real soon and amplify this. I was riveted by your presentation when I went to Washington, D.C. with the group from the United African Movement, visiting the Civil War Memorial, visiting the museum, and, of course, hearing your lecture. People couldn't get enough of this. And it is because the information, as you said, is just routinely not available. So I'll have to ask you to let me know real soon when you can clear a day to come back and further elucidate on this topic.
Well, it will be my pleasure to return.
So let us know again how we get a copy of your book, Liberty, the Light for Light and Liberty, How the War to Preserve the Union Became a War to End Slavery.
At the African American Civil War Museum website, it's afroamcivilwar.org. Again, that's afroamcivilwar.org.
Okay. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, and I especially appreciate the fact that you dealt so well with our little technical problem. It didn't unnerve you, so that is great. Thank you so much for being with us today, and, of course, I'll be in touch to see when next we can schedule you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. You can drop me a note at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, Stories, @gmail.com. I want to thank you so much for being with me today.